This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we're going to be talking with a candidate for president who you may haven't heard of. His name is Walt Brown. He's running on the Socialist Party ticket. Walt Brown, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much, Matt, for having me. It's a plug for the Progressive. I read it 55 years. You can be proud to be hitting it.
Well, that's one of our oldest subscribers, I've got to say, and I'm flattered that you've been with us so long. Tell me, why are you running for president?
Well, first of all, I had not given serious consideration to that until I was approached by a number of socialist groups around the country within the party, and they thought that maybe I was best qualified because I had served in the Oregon State Senate for 12 years, 3 to 4 year terms. And so I've had electoral experience. I'm an attorney, mostly doing consumer law work for over 50 years as an attorney. And I've been a student of public affairs and foreign affairs all my life.
When you served in the legislature in Oregon, was that as a socialist?
That was as a Democrat. We were not on the ballot. Oregon has one of the most repressive state laws against small parties. I won't be on the ballot this year in Oregon. It requires about 17,000 signatures from a small state, and then the write-ins will not be counted. You can write in my name for president, but they don't allocate them to the recipients of those writing candidates. So we're like Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, several other states that are simply hard-nosed about third-party activity.
How many states are you going to be on the ballot?
We were on the ballots in only 7 states last time. I anticipate about 21. Fortunately, I have experience in ballot law. I was when I was in the Senate, I served on a committee to revise our election law, and I understand law. I try to anyway. And if we can be on the ballot in 21 states, I will be very, very happy. And also, if we can get write-ins in another 22, 23 states, that will be very happy. Even getting write-in status is tough. The third parties are not happy campers because the major parties don't want them to camp.
And how is it that the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are able to elbow out third parties and their challengers?
Well, I think it's like in business. Business always wants to get bigger. They want more market penetration. They want the elimination of their competitors. Once they get they're the top dog and maybe the only dog, then they can charge whatever they want. And the same thing with the major parties. They really don't want 30-party competition. It's a pain in the posterior. And there have been occasions in recent years where a third-party competition has caused a flop in representation. Out in New Mexico, a vote for the Greens a few years ago caused a sitting Democrat to be replaced by a reactionary Republican. So you have to, I have to, all my life as a Democratic Socialist, I have to kind of weigh the risk. Some years ago, I was nominated to run for Congress in Oregon's first congressional district. It was an open race. There was a fine, reasonably liberal Chinese-American by the name of David Wu running. There was a reactionary woman Republican by the name of Molly Bordenero. The district almost has a majority Republican administration, and I decided I was not going to get in that race and spoil it, particularly for David Wu, who took a negative stance on giving most favored nation status to communist China. I'm extremely anti-communist. I lived in China. I understand there's a major difference, a world difference between communism and socialism, although some people with small brains and small education don't understand that.
Do you think it was a mistake for the Greens to run Ralph Nader as a last time and that he spoiled it, as some people said?
No, he did not spoil it. What spoiled the election was the fact that, for example, in Florida, thousands upon thousands of good, honest registered voters were barred from the ballot because the Republican Secretary of State put out a list of felons, you know, and if you put out a list of felons, you know, Robert Brown or Willie Brown, you're going to find 100 or 200 or 300 people who have the same first and last name. They were all barred. They didn't use middle initials. It was a ploy, really, to keep the minorities in this country, which tend to vote Democratic or socialist, as the case may be. So, no, it wasn't Ralph Nader. The Socialist Party got enough votes in Florida to have put the election out of the president's hands. But I don't fault us. I think competition should never be faulted.
Now, the person running last time was David McReynolds, correct?
Right.
And how many votes did the Socialist Party get in the last election?
Less than 10,000. And unfortunately, that's a figure that we seem to be stuck at, partially because of ballot access, partially because I think the candidates don't quite have the political experience to know where to focus their efforts. If you focus your efforts a little bit more in states with reasonable ballot access laws, reasonable write-in laws, where we have a infrastructure of Socialist Party organizations, great, you can do that. For example, we didn't get on the ballot in Louisiana. It only cost $500. We should have been on the ballot. We didn't get on the ballot in Mississippi. It only requires a state committee of three or four members. We didn't get on the ballot. You've got to focus on the problem at hand, and that's what I've tried to do all my life. 50 years as a lawyer, and you know, you just have to focus.
Why run if you're only going to get 10,000, or even if you doubled, if you got 20,000? What's the value of running?
It's to get the message across. We live in a country which, in many ways, I think, economically and our standing in the world is kind of going to hell in a handbasket. If we have terrorism against the United States, it's because we have acted ourselves as terrorists. People don't give up their lives and fly planes into buildings and sacrifice their lives unless they really have beefs. Oftentimes these beefs are real. What is it that the American government has done in cohorts with the Saudi Arabian government? Extraction of oil, elimination of the natural resources of that country, not to the benefit of the local people. What did it cause a group of essentially Saudi Arabian young men to sacrifice their lives? One thing that that the Bush has not done is ask why had this happened? Lawyers typically want to know causation. Doctors are less interested in causation than trying to save the patient and get the tourniquet on the right leg. But Bush has never asked the question why. Take, for example, the country of East Timor. American weapons supplied to Indonesia generated an invasion there on Pearl Harbor Day in 1975. 200,000 East Timorese died in the next 24 years. Basically, weapons supplied by the American government to a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But if we'd had East Timorese flying into buildings, I could also understand.
But why. That might have been more understandable. I'm talking with Walt Brown, who's running for president on the Socialist Party ticket. I'm Matt Rothschild. The suggestion that Muhammad Atta or Osama bin Laden, for that matter, may have had a legitimate grievance is debatable, because maybe their grievance was illegitimate. Maybe they want, sure, you know, a Taliban style of oppressive fundamentalist Islamic rule, and therefore they want to fly buildings into planes into buildings.
Yes, yes, this. But at least the question should be asked. I think the question should always be asked.
No, I agree with you there. And there, you know, and it is true that the United States has been in cahoots with Osama bin Laden or people like him who were fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So the United States isn't lily pure here, but it is a question sometimes. I mean, right before, a couple months before September 11th, I was in the office talking with one of my colleagues, and this was just at the time where the Taliban government started to desecrate those Buddhist statues.
Right.
And at that point, we both kind of looked at each other and said, you know, how fascistic is this group here? You know, how bad is this group really going to be? And we'd known for years and written about occasionally, probably not as often as we should have in the pages of The Progressive, about the brutal treatment of women in Afghanistan. So I just don't want to hold them up as, you know, freedom fighters in any sense.
We have the same problem in the Philippines. A century ago, as I came in your office today, I noticed a kind of a press release written by a American Filipino. And I was the senior legal officer at the U.S. Naval Station Subic Bay many years ago. I really integrated into the Philippine community as best I could, became a master mason, belonged to the local Rotary, worked with UNICEF. And we did essentially the same thing 100 years ago when we grabbed the Philippines from the Spanish and overturned fought an insurrection. Americans came back. They were, for years, Americans were pot-shotted at and died. 50% of the Americans that came back from the Philippines were mental casualties. We're going to have the same thing now. We've got suicide. We've already brought 22,000 Americans back from Iraq in physical or mental disability.
Yes, this article that you're referring to was written by a freelancer named Emil Guillermo, and it was about how in 1898 the United States really started its role as a formal empire, and
right.
that now the United States is exercising a similarly formal style of empire in Iraq, whereas in the years in between, most of the time it was acting in a kind of neo-imperialistic way, but now this is almost a traditional 19th century colonial rule over there.
Mm-hmm. Well, with our occupation of Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, I'm not sure it was too much neo about it, but it obviously we thought that we were bringing democracy, Christianity, all that sort of thing to those areas. In fact, the Philippines had been colonized by the Spanish. It was mostly Christian. They had great resources, great military potential for bases. And when McKinley pushed that, you know, we only had the interest of the United States in mind.
I mean, knowing U.S. history as you do, Walt Brown, to what extent do you think the Bush administration's policies are simply a continuation of the standard American foreign policy over the last 100 years? And to what extent is it a fundamental departure?
It's a continuation. It's a continuum. For example, our support of Sukarno and Suharto in Indonesia was support, on one hand, because they were ostensibly anti-communist. But on the other hand, Achea in the on the island of Sumatra has massive oil reserves, oil that does not have sulfur in it, and that oil is brought to the West Coast and it's easy to refine. We're interested in supporting dictators oftentimes because they can do good things for us, like sell us sweet or sulfur-free oil.
And mobile oil is right there.
Yes, yes, yes. Those governments can do nothing to increase our status in the world as democracy-loving people. In fact, we sell our soul, our political soul, by using those means to reach some oil end. That's one of the problems with East Timor. They've got oil, the fact, of course, that they were Christian, mostly Roman Catholic, they were black, mostly from New Guinea, means that the Indonesian government were after them. We've got the same problems in the Middle East. Oil, oil, oil. And, of course, I've not really been a student of the political policies of American Arabian Oil Company, Aramco, yesteryear, but we've been after their oil for years and years.
You're listening to Walt Brown, who's running for president on the Socialist Party ticket. What are some of the major issues, or what's the platform that you're running on?
Well, basically, economic democracy. Now, people say, what on earth is economic democracy? Let me give you an example. Here in Wisconsin, there hasn't been a municipal power department formed since the mid-1940s. We have 50 cities, some as small as 5,000 population, which do have municipal power departments. And those departments are able to deliver electricity to their commercial and to their residential customers at 10 to 30% less than the going rate now. You see yesterday's headlines, one plant building auto parts is going to be leaving for either Mexico or China. Why? Because one of their major cost centers, electricity, is going through the roof. businesses do not move from place A to B because it's expensive to move unless they have good economic reason to do so. They move because of power cost.
A lot of time they move because of labor cost.
Yeah. They do. We had in my Senate district, a Pendleton Woolen Mills plant hired about 100 women, mostly single parents, divorcees, widows, paid $10 an hour to sew shirts, $2 fringe benefits for a total of 12. And when the Clinton Bush Sr. NAFTA was passed, they moved to Mexico where the hourly rate is not $12, but 50 cents. And all those 100 women were out on the street. That is not a way to run an economic railroad. I don't think that the president, with his tax policies and his support for NAFTA and GATT and the extension of these to Peru and to Malaysia or to Singapore, he really understands. I would challenge the president to let us see his Colley's transcripts from Yale, where he got a B minus average. He might have got a B minus. Oh, I'm sorry, it was a C minus. A C minus average. He might have got a C minus in history, but I'm sure his economics were even less. Probably confidential.
How do you prevent a company from moving like that?
You write the tax laws. In a way, right now, when a company moves overseas, they do not have to pay taxes on their income until they bring those incomes back into the United States. What they can do is capitalize it, put up bigger and bigger plants, and until they have an empire of industrial activity overseas. Typically, these are in dictatorships or third world countries without much of a standard of living, without workers' comp, retirement benefits, health benefits, and they can go a long way hoping that sooner or later Congress will lower the taxes on them, which Congress has done recently.
So you think it would be possible if you got enough people in Congress or that you had a president who wanted to tax these companies that were moving, that would give them a negative incentive so that they would stay where they are?
Yes. Big business follows the profits. The famous economist from the University of Chicago, Friedman, said big business corporations only really have one moral commitment. That's to their stockholders, to increase the dividends and to increase the share values. They don't have they don't have commitments to workers. They don't have commitments to customers, consumers.
Not really a moral commitment after all.
Yeah, maybe it's immoral, but it's a commitment to the bottom line. And that's why I support consumer cooperatives. The United States government has never had to bail out consumer cooperatives in this country. Why I support credit unions. The United States has never had to bail out credit unions as they have commercial banks. Credit unions were kind of invented by German socialists. Consumer co-ops were invented by British socialists. Universal healthcare with the single-payer mode were invented by Canadian socialists in the province of Saskatchewan in the early 1960s. These are all what I would call economic democracy, but we also got a battle in this country for, let us say, social democracy, where people, regardless of their race, religion, creed, color, sexual orientation, ethnicity, are going to be given an equal status in the ship of state and not kicked around. It was Emma Lazarus, the socialist, who put the sonnet on the Statue of Liberty, or maybe they just adopted it from her. You know, send us your tired, your hungry, your huddled masses yearning to be free. We believe in freedom for everyone. Theologically, I'm a kind of a Unitarian Universalist, which means to me that all people are God's children, and we need to treat everyone like our brothers.
I'm speaking with Walt Brown, who's running for president on the Socialist Party ticket. When and how did you become a socialist?
1948, at the time as a 21-year-older at University of Southern California, a freshman in the law school, I had the problem of who was I going to vote for in that election? Was I going to vote for Tom Dewey, whose record as Attorney General and Governor in New York, I believe, was not what I would admire? Harry Truman, many good things going for him, but he had to have his arm twisted to desegregate the armed forces. And he could not tell the difference, I think, between a communist and a socialist. When Germany had its structure developed under Truman after World War II, he broke off West Germany from West Berlin from West Germany. So the German Social Democrats could not get a fair shot at the majority in the German parliament. Henry Wallace, at least in California, was under the control of the communist. Strom Thurmond, a Dixiecrat, had some difficulty agreeing with the results of the Civil War and the contents of the Constitution. That left Norman Thomas. Now, granted, Norman Thomas' main claim to fame was a theological degree from Princeton, but I don't fault people who support the moral teachings of Jesus. But when he left Princeton as a Brahmin from a fine family, he established a church or went to a church in Harlem, which was all black. I thought that was pretty incredible. He was a peace supporter. He was instrumental in the civil rights movement in this country. I didn't support his pacifism just before the outbreak of World War II. I saw films of the Italians, Air Force, machine gunning Abyssinians, and saw pictures of the German infantry being unloaded in Spanish docks next to U.S. Standard Oil ships. We have bad people in this world who get a hold of guns. We have to watch them. Unfortunately, as in the case of Iraq, many of these guns were sold to them by the United States, which likes to foster a balance of trade. And we think that gun exports or weapons exports is part of.
Did you ever meet? I'm sorry. Did you ever meet Norman Thomas?
Yes.
What was he like?
Great, tall, impressive, full of fire. When I headed up a Democratic Socialist student group at the University of Southern California at the time of the 48 election, we had Boulevard Auditorium, which held a couple thousand people, and we rented it or we leased it or we made arrangements to have him talk there. When the conservative administration discovered that Norman Thomas, the Socialist, was going to speak in the great Boulevard Auditorium, they relegated us to a small auditorium. And I remember when we started the meeting, I said, would the people sitting in the aisles move closer together so we could have more in this room? Well, the fire code was being fractured, but Norman Thomas was great. Great, great.
Why do you think the cause of socialism seems to have become less popular in the United States since those days of Norman Thomas?
I think that the Republican and the Democratic parties have used the name to batter the Socialist Party over the head. The name Socialist came out of a consumer cooperative magazine in 1828 to describe the work of John Owen, who was a wealthy Welsh mill owner who came up with the notion that if you treat your workers decently, they will be more productive, and that there maybe is a form of economics that could be viable where the workers got to control the plant, economic democracy. But, of course, along many years later comes Karl Marx and Stalin and Trotsky and Lenin and Hitler, all using the term socialist in their political labels. They have nothing to do with socialism. Socialism is democracy, has to survive in a democratic environment. We take the position there is no true democracy without socialism. There's no true socialism without democracy. Democracy in economics, democracy in politics, democracy in social relationships.
But do you ever think there's just too much of an uphill struggle using that name, embracing that name, given all the baggage it carries with it?
That's a good question. I've run for Congress now three times, 98, 2000, and 2002 in Oregon. During those three elections, I didn't receive a single phone call or a single letter from someone who is bad-mouthing our efforts to run as a socialist party. Now, maybe they were unwilling to attack a guy who is a little older than average, who had was a veteran of three wars and was a retired Navy commander with a chest full of medals and had 4 degrees and had an A-minus average, not a C-minus average. But no one has bothered me. The first time in now 6 years of practical politics that I had somebody throw Socialism is like communism, was a Seventh-day Adventist minister in Milwaukee who obviously had too much divinity training and not enough history, political science, and economic training. I don't fault him. He's not very bright and not very well educated. And I told him, you know, I said, I got the Medal of Freedom Award with my wife from the Oregon Conference of Seventh-day Adventists for doing good things for a minority religious group in the state legislature. They get kicked around because they have their Sabbath on Saturday. He seemed to be very puzzled how a socialist could get the Freedom Award from the Seventh-day Adventist Conference in Oregon. But he's got his problems, you know. As my dad would say, he's got his problems, I've got mine. I only have run into one person now in 5 years.
And yet in those occasions where you ran for Congress in Oregon on the Socialist Party ticket, you only got a couple thousand votes.
I got over 10,000 votes the first time around. And then that was in a three-way race. We've had races in Oregon where we've got over 25% of the vote in a two-way contest. So people are extremely cordial, I think, to democratic socialist ideas. The moment you tell them credit unions, consumer co-ops, REI, Recreation Equipment Incorporated, Medicare, public power, don't drop bombs on small villages of containing children and women. They come on and say, oh, I didn't quite realize. Or they say, oh, I've always known this. I learned something about Eugene Debs or Norma Thomas or A. Philip Randolph when I was in school. Great, great. I'll support you.
I'm talking with Walt Brown, who's running for president on the Socialist Party ticket. We only have a couple minutes left. I just want you to try to situate where we are in this country right now with the Bush administration. How scary is the Bush administration to you? How frightened should people be or on the alert about the direction they're taking this country?
George Orwell in 1937 wrote a book called The Road to Wigan Pier. It was a study of poverty in the coal mining districts of England. At the end of that book, he said, if we do not establish a viable Democratic Socialist Party in England, I fear that fascism may well come about. I have that same fear in this country. Congress, Kerry, every senator in the U.S. Senate, with the exception of your
Russ Feingold
herein, voted for the USA Patriot Act. If American congressmen and senators cannot understand the difference between civil liberties and the Constitution and the needs to protect ourselves, then we're in sad shape. We have corporate takeover, essentially, of the government. And that's how Benito Mussolini defined fascism, corporate control of the government because of the lack of campaign finance regulations, because of the lack of public funding of elections. I think we're in very serious straits.
Well, Walt Brown, that's got to be the last sobering thought for the day. Walt Brown is running for president on the Socialist Party ticket. I'm Matt Rothschild, and stay tuned next week for another edition of Progressive Radio. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.